All right. Everybody, welcome to the December edition of In the Now. JP.
Welcome.
Welcome to you.
And VR again.
Welcome.
And Dimitri.
Hello, all.
How you guys doing?
Dandy.
Poorly, actually.
I'm mediocre.
I'm below average.
I'm not sure yet.
I'm in the upper echelon.
But I do know that we've got some interesting stories tonight. We're going to go, because we're getting a little bit better at this, we're going to be spending less time on multiple articles and more time on smaller amount of articles, so we can focus on the story and move from one story to the next. All right. Guess we'll start it out. If anybody else has anything else to say or no?
I just realized that we follow pretty much the same format as the Savage Nation.
Or I think the Savage Nation follows pretty much the format of most other radio stations.
Oh.
That's pretty much it. I mean, you introduce yourself and you get to the news.
I was referring to the metal.
Oh, the metal. That's right.
Yeah, that was a refreshing change tonight.
Oh, yeah, the metal. I'm thinking about bringing some techno in.
Yeah.
All right. Bush for private network. This is a pretty good idea, actually. I'm kind of proud of Bush for this. Bush wants an unhackable private network. Basically, he wants all of the government to be on their own private internet, which is essentially what I think the government should do. And it's completely separate from the outside world and allows them to be more secure and pass information more freely.
No such thing as unhackable. Whoever made it can hack it.
Well, unless they run their complete own separate lines, and then maybe they can still hack it. But imagine the cost involved in that.
Well,
just running the whole wires to every office across the world for this private, governmental network.
Well, it's not. Well, when you say unhackable, you just shoot for the best. So you say, I want an unhackable network. You might not get it. And then the wires, actually, most of the wires are already in place for a lot of the private networks for the main buildings, like the Pentagon's connected to certain buildings, and all across the United States and the military have their own networks, and, the underground bases have their own networks. And a lot of it is these networks come through routers at facilities, and basically you can make those routers separate, and the wire's already there. You just do clear physical...
Where you'd have to hardwire it.
Yeah, you basically make sure that there's no physical connections from their network to the outside network. So, sounds like a good idea. Hope they do it.
But see, then there's a problem if anyone gets on, they can't get on the internet. The external internet. Otherwise, there would be a bridge over in a computer.
You can have a internet machine that's not connected to the rest of the network.
Well, then what if you want to exchange information?
Put it on a
disk.
Oh, yeah, wow, there's a hole.
But they're pretty strict, a lot of the places, there's a guy that just started working with us, and he worked for the Navy, and they had to change their password every 30 days. They couldn't bring in outside media disks and whatnot. They probably wouldn't do that. They probably have a policy that they probably wouldn't even have any internet machines in there. And say, too bad, you want to do that, fine. And then the email, you'd only send email internally, so that's why they'd have their internal network, and they probably wouldn't send it externally. I'm not sure what they're doing, but I would probably guess that that's what they're doing. And if you wanted to send anything outside, I'm sure they'll maybe have some way to do it, but it's probably a strict procedure that they'll want to look at what you're sending and how it's getting out and whatnot, so... I think it's definitely what they should do. I mean, it's what they did in the past when they had information. It never left the building. And if it did, you had to have some sort of clearance or whatnot. They had vehicles of how to get that information out, but it was pretty strict on how they did it. So they basically opened up themselves to the world by putting the internet in, but they now by doing a private network, they're basically essentially going back to their old tactics of shutting everybody out, and it's all kept internally. And that's the proper system, I would think, to keep their network internally, just having a private network. So, anybody else have any comments on that before I move on?
Nope.
All right. NASA goes to Pluto. Basically, they just want to send a...
And are they going to stay there?
I don't know. I think they're actually going to send it... Well, I think they are, because it's not really going to... I doubt they're going to have it go out and come back. I think it's just going to stay out there like a lot of other satellites. I think we have a satellite next to Jupiter. that's out there that's projecting information back to us?
We have quite a few out there. We just don't have one as far as Pluto.
Actually, yeah.
Or we do have one, but it's not operable anymore.
Voyager actually should be past it by now. It might be another one.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've kept any track of all those.
Of course, then there's the one that just went away. It's probably in another solar system by now.
Okay, that's the one that's probably Voyager.
Yeah.
Too bad there was nobody inside it.
Well, they did have this nice little gold, actually...
Oh, the plate?
The record. It was actually a record.
Uh-huh.
That had, you know, two naked people on it.
Yeah, but they weren't touching because they didn't want the aliens to think that it was one being.
Right. And one, only one hand raised. The guy has his hand raised. How?
NASA selected a proposal to proceed with Phase B. Basically, you know, I think it's different departments or different companies come up with proposals of these things, and then they accept it. It's kind of like a job contracting, I guess, it seems like. For a Pluto-Kuiper belt, PKB mission.
Kepler,
okay, my bad. Intended to explore the most distant planet in the solar system, the mission will also explore the Kuiper belt beyond Pluto. Source of comets and believed to be the source of much of Earth's water and the simple chemical precursors of life. The scientific value of the mission is highly dependent on a 2006 launch that achieves a flyby of Pluto well before 2020. In order to ensure this launch date, NASA has established two conditions that must be successfully met at the conclusion of Phase B. First, the mission must pass a confirmation view that will address significant risks such as schedule and basically, it's just they have their whole spiel that they want to make sure that they're going to put the money in this thing and it's going to work. And it's going to be very interesting once they do.
I'm sad because we won't go to other solar systems in my lifetime.
I'm sad too, actually. I want to actually live on the moon or Mars when they cultivate it and put people up there.
Yeah, you know, I was having a conversation the other day about the hoax of the moon, you know, the landing on the moon. And I thought it was about some really interesting things. As they were talking about the images of the astronauts on the moon. There's no atmosphere on the moon, so it really doesn't matter if it's light or dark. You should be able to see the stars, right?
That's what I heard.
Yeah, but there's no stars in the video.
You look at it now, you look at the photos they have, they're probably in an atmosphere, but so thin that you still don't see stars. You know, when they're just outside and they have video of, like, them floating around Earth, you still don't see any stars anywhere. And it could be just because they need to have a lot of contrast, a different type of contrast, so they get rid of all the external. And, you know, so they can see the people well, so they can see the ground well.
Wasn't there a question of the flag waving?
That's why we still.
Actually, there's a thing called solar wind, which actually they've been also working on utilizing that as a form of propulsion, of actually having a great big sail.
Yeah.
That would catch it and eventually go really fast. But also, you know, I'm not sure if you've ever tried to see it with your telescope. I would love to try.
See the flag?
To see the flag, because...
They say you can't.
Right. But now, they supposedly landed on the dark side of the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's essentially where the Sea of Tranquility is. But then how did we know where it is if it's on the dark side of the moon?
Plus, if it's on the dark side of the moon, how come they were so bright?
Now, that was my thought. That's what's really kind of kooky. Why doesn't anybody be able to see it?
And does anyone else find it interesting that there's even a dark side of the moon? It happens to have that exact specific within 0.000 tolerance that it rotates at exact speed that we never see the other face. I mean, what's the probability of that?
Actually, I think that's the only orbiting mass that does that.
Those are.
But that's because it's an egg.
You know, I could find reasons to prove, like, that it did happen, or at least give, you know, evidence that it did, that they did do that. But then I could think of, like, things like, you know, the radiation belt out there, and that the whole bunch of other things that could disprove that they went to the moon.
Yeah, but just by critical thinking, you know, it brings up a whole lot more questions than anything else.
But even if it was a fake, fine by me. I mean, I know we'd finally get there, and basically, with that, it sparked a whole generation of people interested in going even further there. So if it was a fake, it promoted so many good things.
But yet our attempts to go to the moon, and was it Apollo 13, actually what pretty much ceased a lot of, actually space exploration. And attention came back on Earth, but not externally. That's why it's taken us, 20 some odd years to even send something to Mars that's known about.
Well, I think when I think a lot of it is that they said, hey, if we're going to go to Mars, we're going to want to do it right. So if we don't have the technology to quite get there and do what we want to do, we're going to wait. And we got plenty of time. And meanwhile, they've been doing a lot of experiments with everything. Human beings and everything else to figure out what space is like. And maybe they wanted a more thorough mission to Mars. So that's why they're waiting for the technology to come about. And instead of paying all this money just to drop a rock on Mars and try to get back, make it kind of more luxurious than that, and maybe that's kind of the point I'm trying to make. I think that's what they're trying to do, is wait for the technology to come about and do a more thorough mission this time.
There's supposed to be commercialized travel to the moon eventually, so we'll see if there's a company that will get people to the moon.
Oh, yeah, then we'll actually be on the moon, finally.
I would imagine that they did it to start with.
Except now, what the really neat thing is that there's actually companies in, like, South America that are private companies that can actually put satellites up for you if you want. Hmm. So I was talking with a few friends before Carl Sagan's Mars station went out there. Is we figured out a way that you could actually create a little rocket. Just actually would work on hairspray. And we could actually have it put up by a private company, and now in this, like, little, it could just be one of those shipping tubes, those cardboard shipping tubes, with a hairspray on it, with a little remote control, like radio sending unit, and shoot it off, have the company send it up, put it in orbit, wait until the right time to trigger the hairspray, which would be actually the propulsion to get it to Mars or the moon. And when it hit the moon, the cardboard would disintegrate and leave our flag. And we would
so beautiful.
And we would have claimed ownership of Mars.
Now, do you mean the American flag or your personal flag?
My personal flag. So then I could charge NASA $1.5 million per square foot of rent on Mars for eternity.
That's before they bomb you. That's before they kill you and make you disappear, and there'd never be a VR existence ever.
And have to be a little more than cardboard to withstand leaving the atmosphere, though.
No, well, it would be actually shipped up on a commercial.
Right. Gotcha.
Be put in the right orbit for us, and then we just have to trigger it.
Mars has an atmosphere like ours, though, really.
Actually, it's much, much thinner.
It could be like ours, but it still has an atmosphere which would burn everything up.
They have a plant to cultivate it.
Well, actually, it would be easy enough to actually, because it's so light, with a very small, a pretty good-sized parachute, it would actually survive.
I just think it's interesting that
am I too loud?
Everybody kind of takes for granted that the human body operates under zero-gravity conditions. I think that's really interesting because it's so not a given. Like, isn't that amazing that no part of our body, our heart pumping, our juices flowing through the blood system, excretion, whatever, what have you, none of it requires gravity to work? I find that amazing. Like,
yeah,
from a religious standpoint, what do you mean? Because we can survive in space.
Well, not for very long.
Well, okay, the muscles weaken and stuff, but I'm saying you don't go up there and your heart starts pumping all of a sudden.
Yeah,
well, because most of your system is based off pressure anyways. I mean, when you can drink some water while you're laying down, it's still going to get to your stomach.
Well, you can also eat while standing on your head.
Yeah, exactly. Everything, like all the valves have, I don't know what the technical name is, but they
sphincters.
Have the certain switches so that stuff can only travel in one direction. Now, why, from even a evolution or creationist standpoint, why would we be made that way if we're meant to stay on Earth? Or if we didn't, from an evolution standpoint, if we came from Earth,
well,
we evolved that. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it would. There would only be actually a 90 degree, from gravity, because we do lay down quite often, and we stand up. So there's really only a 90 degree difference.
So when your body, if you want to roll or
right,
run
so,
and jump or
so it would be conducive for our body to evolve that way, because even slight incline, when we're laying down, would essentially do the same thing, actually even worse than zero Gs, except for the pressure of the atmosphere. And yes, we cannot survive in a large variation of pressure. But now different angles, yes, I can completely understand that.
Perhaps I see your point, but still, those things on Earth are for, like, perhaps I see split second things, but for, like, months on end to be able to survive in space without completely, immediately, your heart burst or something. To me, that's still interesting. Because
months on end, well, actually,
it would be more like
at all.
We expand.
Not easy, but it's possible.
We probably do expand as we grow, because I forget the guy's name that spent, it was the first astronaut to spend more than a year in space. He actually grew an inch. He expanded an inch.
Hook me up.
Because there's also, there's all kinds of different connective fibers in our body. I'm not remembering them. I just learned them the other day, but now I can't remember them. That's a good thing I'm not becoming a doctor.
So if he lived up there, he
might
be.
Speaking of doctor and human.
You're welcome Segway. For that transition.
Is.
Segway Sam.
Scientists build tiny computer from DNA. All right.
Huh? Are we good in the whole transition or what?
Yeah.
That was freaking
beautiful. Hence my fire right there.
Speaking of being good, I hear those tiny computers are really good.
Yeah.
That was bad.
Yeah, that was really bad.
Speaking of
speaking of the story, scientists build tiny computer from DNA. You know, these stories are pretty vague whenever you read them as far as, like, the real technology. It's kind of like saying, yo, we built something out of DNA, and we get it to work, and it does these operations. The thing that really interests me before I go in this article is that I want to know what kind of interface it is. Do they watch the molecules and the atoms and the nucleuses, and they say, oh, they're building themselves in a organized structure, or is it like, you know, they plug this somehow into a monitor and have some sort of interface? Or I really wish that they would put stuff like that into
or
the
it grows an ear when the answer is right.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Following Mother Nature's lead, Israel scientists have built a DNA computer so tiny that a trillion of them could fit in a test tube and perform billion operations per second with 99.8% accuracy. Does it let you know when the 0.2 accuracy
is
wrong?
Well, that's what I was just thinking. Is that the aggregate error or just, you know, that's each individual process has a 98?
I think so.
Is it each individual process?
I think a total.
What if they wrote the article with that piece of merchandise, then? You have to be careful.
Yeah.
Because that statistic could be wrong by 0.2%.
Could be.
It would have to be on. All right.
Instead of using figures and formulas to solve a problem, the microscopic computer's input, output, and software are made up of DNA molecules, which store and process and code information in living organisms. Actually, yes, right. This one tells you. It is by looking at the molecules and stuff and how they're organized that it does create a structure of organization that tells you what the answer is. Scientists see such DNA computers as a future competitors to their more conventional cuisines because... All right, I'm starting from scratch. I did this terribly bad. Scientists see such DNA computers as future competitors for their more conventional cousins because miniaturism is reaching its limits and DNA has potential to be much faster than conventional computers. All right, it was a strange sentence. Threw me off. We have built a nanoscale computer made of biomolecules that are so small you cannot run them. You cannot run them one at a time. When a trillion computers run together, they are capable of performing a billion operations. It is the first programmable autonomous computing machine in which the input, output, software, and hardware are all made of biomolecules.
Hope those machines don't replace us because a slip's 0.5% error ratio just showed up.
Yeah, and these things are probably better than my point.
Well, now what really interests me is now are these computers able to reproduce themselves and actually create a variance? Now, if it has a point. Was a 98.2% error in that. Those actually, that program and those computers, when it's self-replicating, would actually go take on mutations and evolution.
Well, that's what
actually.
Go ahead.
Actually, there was a computer created, I believe it was about a year and a half ago, that in a sense could evolve. I don't know if you heard of it, but it created variations of itself, and then it would weed out. Basically, it was some sort of small thingamajig that it moved and it had a small arm, something like that, and it could create other things identical to it, and then it would test them and eliminate the worst ones. So then that one would be faster, and it would evolve. It would do this for several generations, then the final one would be better than the original one.
Yeah, I think we talked that back over the summer in like April or so.
Well, this one is,
but this is the very structure.
Yeah, this is
even, this is the program.
Way more interesting.
Yeah,
yeah, this is a like that one was limited, and you know, we talked before about AI and AI, true AI. I mean, I guess to put it from a programmer standpoint, is source code writing its own source code, and being able to go outside of its own box. And essentially, computers are within a large box compared to some of the other structures in nature. I mean, it's probably not even really a structure of nature. That's what makes it so inefficient compared to structures that are of nature. And, yeah, that's why I wanted to really bring this article in, is to it's because it's pretty, you know, okay, we talked about the nanotechnologies. We talk about interfacing parts of the body into some sort of technological electronic equipment. And we've talked about actually, I don't know if we talked about it, but I read an article about once that, you know, with, actually, you know what, I think it may be these DNA computers. I think in this article, yeah, that they could design little DNA computers that could watch systems of your body and basically say, like, oh, this system's running good, oh, this system's running bad, oh, this system has a virus, okay, bring in this antibody or anti-agent to come and kill it. I mean, you could fight cancer at a much higher level with, if you had an intelligent system watching over your cells, other than just trying to put in some sort of inoculant that's going to come through and wipe it out. I mean, it's not going to be able to do it. So this is, it's pretty amazing.
Well, I think it would be more of a proactive system in like the case of cancer and those kinds of things, because if they make it a reactive system, it can also cause many more problems.
Yeah, it's from what I'm understanding when I was reading it, it's more of a proactive system. But I mean, who knows? Like, this kind of stuff could be put into all sorts of stuff in the future. Basically, I think the in the now portion of this is, the future is, you know, tying these things, and we're going to see a whole new brand of ways that we're going to be able to do work on our own human bodies. And it, you know, some of it's kind of scary, and I guess in some ways it's kind of satanic in a way. It's unnatural. It's not. It's one of those things that people are going to fight about, especially the cloning issue. And
well, how really unnatural is it when it's actually using the base form or our architecture? For our form, our organism.
Why do we need technology? To me, it seems kind of funny. We, our brains, our bodies, create technology to help our brain. What the crap? Can't we just do it on our own without a computer to do it? Why can't we just get rid of cancer with our brain? Shouldn't it be that ultimate machine?
See, I personally believe yes. No one's proven me wrong or right
yet. I have
yet.
Some sort of belief that that's true in some ways.
But it was all my kooky theories. In another 20 years, I'll probably be proven right. Is if we focus our attention on it, because I've seen and I've heard of a whole lot of things with spontaneous remission, with people's attitudes and focus in their body.
Mm-hmm.
All right, what really is that? Is that they blame that on faith or use the justification for faith in God? But what really is that?
Faith.
When you can do amazing things through hypnosis and prayer. Is actually the same kind of thing that ritual that you go through with prayer is very similar as hypnosis. You're essentially just reprogramming your mind.
Well, that's what they do at churches. Don't you notice that at all?
Oh,
go
very
to a church.
Much.
That's the first, you're like it's like a a psychiatrist.
Same
you know,
thing with boot camp, essentially.
Yeah, these are all actually
the same thing. Yeah,
they're normally called societal degradation ceremonies. That it's a way of breaking down your place in society and your mental attitudes.
And building yourself back up.
In a different way. And so you can actually do these in little command lines, as in like code, but you do it through suggestion. And you could probably actually change your form all the way up to your phenotype, let alone the inner workings of your metabolism or anything like that.
I've read... And I studied this. I did a report on it a while ago, but I don't know how true it is. It's like a Dr. Weil or something, or some guy like that, some doctor, said that this kid had a problem. It was some disease. I can't remember what it was, but he had a disease that was genetic.
I know the story.
And they put this kid under hypnosis, and told him to get better some way. I can't remember, but the kid came back and his DNA had changed. I wish I could bring back the story, but
here's one that's very similar to that. It was actually he's a really famous sociologist by the name of Cooley. He actually was stricken with I forget what disease it was, but he later, you know, he was pretty much bedridden most of his childhood, and how he recovered was he actually envisioned himself using his hands, using his feet in play and in work, and eventually he was able to, you know, get out of bed, actually do it, which is that's a complete mental construct, which affected his physiology.
I heard a story once. I have two comments. I heard a story once that my brother told me that I don't know most of the details, but I do know the main part of the story, which is the doctor was giving out these pills saying it would cure whatever your problem. It was brain tumors, and it said it would cure your brain tumor, and the people took the pills and their brain tumors reduced to a large amount, and then he did it as an experiment, and he said, this thing will absolutely cure your brain tumor, take it, and it did, and then it didn't get rid of them, it just reduced them, and then after that, he told me, he's like, well, you know, I didn't really expect this to work, but these pills don't do anything, they're just kind of like an aspirin, and their brain tumors started coming back.
Yeah, that's the placebo effect, which I guess everything we're talking about would be, the placebo effect would be the obvious and scientifically proven manifestation of that. And while that's small, the question is, how far does that effect go, I guess is what we're all asking.
Well, if it affects just with the idea of a pill that this will help me, and it affects studies immensely, that there's usually always a placebo effect in some way or another. Even, you know, you see those things on TV for like Claritin and all that. Mm. Even in the placebo group, they say, oh yeah, the side effects were no different than in the placebo group, like backaches, headaches, nausea. Like, pretty much, okay, I don't want to take the pill just for the placebo side effects. But where was I going with that?
Well, my second comment was
not on that.
My second comment was that
I have some pills I can give you that'll help that after the show.
Okay, thank you.
You're
healed.
VR, what you're talking about earlier is about how can it be kind of an unnatural thing if it's built up of nature and using nature to create these effects through DNA and whatnot.
Well, how do we really know that our DNA doesn't already do that?
Well, let me. Okay. Is that basically it's not talking about the natural process of our DNA doing these certain things. It's about basically, you know, human cloning or cloning period is taking a natural process and tweaking it in quite a profound way to make something happen. What I'm saying is, like, it's not the technology which is based off nature. It's the effect afterwards that we're trying to produce, and if that's an effect that we really want, you know what I mean? These are not answers that I don't think anybody of us could come up in this room with right away on tons of different topics of what could be done with some of the technology that's coming up, and it's going to be highly debated. But some things, I mean, personally in my mind, that human cloning is, I don't like it at all. I mean, to bring this up really quick, Dinner, to just throw this in for thought, is that, you know, they're talking about for human cloning, like, okay, we're not going to clone humans for humans just to walk around. We're going to clone humans for body parts. Well, I mean, geez, you're going to clone this guy. You're going to make him to a certain age because you're going to match these body parts with another person's body part. What are you going to do, slaughter him and then cut him up for parts? I mean, what is that?
You're supposed to actually create just the organ.
Yeah, they can actually do that.
Do you think the organ's going to be strong? Is it going to be healthy? Is it going to be, like, used to functioning in a certain environment? Like, when you buy a new car, you get, for the first 500 miles, you got to drive it nicely to get it tuned up for, you know, actually driving it to a faster point. Because if you, let's just say you get a brand new car and you start driving around 100 miles an hour on that thing, you're going to tweak the engine and the engine's going to break down later because you put in structural cracks because the heat didn't fuse it, the metal didn't fuse itself upon the parts at a comfortable heat level. I mean, that's... Maybe they'll come over that, but...
Well, there's a big thing that they actually were able to splice in a mouse with a human ear growing off its back. That kind of thing they can do. So that it could be able to be worked on animals, so it would be working, more than likely, but that's just an idea.
Think about all those poor deaf mice running around.
Yeah, like, well... That just makes them easier to get caught.
Right. Blind mice.
We're going to do a major swing in what we're talking about now to a news story, which basically goes along with the Linux, Microsoft stuff. Linux is getting more recognized, and it's moving along more, and it's getting better support, and it's working better. than it has before in the past with the new kernels and whatnot. And this is going to be some heavily reading of the article. Actually, not this very article, but the next one. This main article right here is basically a memo from Microsoft talking about how Linux is not a threat, it is the threat to Microsoft. Linux is the long-term threat against our core business. Never forget that. Microsoft Windows Division Veet Brian Valentin exclaims in a confidential memo to his sales brown shirts obtained by the Register. The core outrage from Valentin's perspective is that the Sun and IBM shops migrating in droves to a cheaper Intel platform and observing along the way that Linux is a good deal easier to deal with if you're already acquainted with the Unix. I'm trying to read through the article where they have the commentary and stuff like that. That's not so important. That's going to be that way in the next article, too, so bear with me. Kind of the key idea behind Linux, but we digress, which is a lot easier to deal with instead of Unix. I need to make sure that many of these customers are possible to continue to migrate. Okay. I need to make sure that many of these customers are, as possible, continue to migrate off of Unix, but onto Windows 2000 on Intel, Valentin says. You should be smothering your accounts from every angle. If you see Linux and IBM in there with it, then get all over them. Don't lose a single win to Linux. Valentin's hard sell hall monitors will be marching through a data center near you, we gather, searching for open source contaminants and anything else that breathes in the marketplace and consumes their air. If you haven't done it at your customer sites, then do a walkthrough of their data centers and take inventory of where you see Sun machines, IBM, etc., and ask them what they're running on those machines. Learn about what they do with those systems. Keep that inventory in your back pocket. Hell, tattoo it on your butt, and if you have to, go after them. Knock them out of the machine, one machine at a time, one application, one department at a time. I cannot stress how important this is. It's no secret that Microsoft has long regarded Linux as a threat, at least not since Eric Raymond broke the news 2 years ago that the infamous Halloween documents. It's lovely to see it becoming the threat, apparently because it empowers people to operate computers and networks without buying into the nebulous Microsoft.net vision, which you will see below. The company thinks of as something to be positioning, something to be positioned by its products. And this is going to go straight into the email. That was actually just a precursor story. This is from Brian Valentin to the WW Sales Marketing Services Group. Subject, hello again, long time, no talk. And there's some more that was blurped out. Linux wins and updates. I'd like to share with you some great Linux wins we had recently. But before I do, I need to highlight a trend that we're seeing with many of our customers. They're fed up with the expensive Unix risk solutions from Sun, HP, and IBM. They're looking to move, and they want to migrate to the Intel platform. Unfortunately, because Linux is very similar to Unix, importing applications from Unix to Linux isn't that hard. We're starting to see customers move from Unix applications to Linux on Intel platforms. I need you to make sure that as many of these customers are as possible, continue to migrate off of Unix, but onto the Windows 2000 on Intel. There are many of these things that you need to watch out for with the Linux and Linux compete team. Has Busy created some great collation to help you win. I was just saying, watch out for Linux. One thing you need to have to always keep in mind here: Linux is a long-term threat against our core business. Never forget that. You should be smothering your accounts from every angle, and if you see Linux or IBM with it in there, then get all over it. Don't lose a single win to Linux. If you have not done it, you should inventory. Well, that's pretty much what the other one beginning said, but we're going to go over this one. Now onto the wins. Let's hear it from Mandy Samuelson and her account team in Melbourne, Australia. They were competing head-to-head with IBM, who was proposing a Linux solution, and JB were holding a worldwide stockbroker firm. In this time of economic downturn, IBM had almost their customer convinced that Linux was a low-cost platform of choice on 126 servers. Mandy's team stepped in and fought tooth and nail for the business, displacing the IBM Linux threat for a platform win worth over $400,000. How did they do it? By selling the advantages of our platform in the new volume licensing program. Licensing program, what's so great about that? The customer saw that the value in the changes and believed that the Microsoft platform, in the Microsoft platform, decided to take advantage of the savings. Thank you, team. That's one less tattoo Manny and the crew will have to get. There's more congratulations to the other teams. But, I mean, you heard it right there. They're pretty worried about the Linux platform. And then by selling it, they said that they impressed them with the licensing of Windows. What does that have to do with anything? And they paid $400,000. I'm sure they would have paid a lot less for Linux. I'm sure they used a lot of tricky Microsoft tactics. I really don't know how they won that over. But so I guess Linux is pretty much a threat to them, and they really want to make sure that it doesn't get ahead of them. So that's proof right there. You guys distracted?
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to move on to another large story, and I've actually read this one. It's better written than the last one. Built to Linux, you owe me. Now, hopefully nobody gets bored, because this is going to be an interesting story and every bit of information. What was that?
Well, can I go to the bathroom before we start then?
Well, you can do that whenever.
Oh, okay, great.
You're going to leave for that, aren't you?
Well, oh, okay, yeah. I was just planning on going to the quarter.
Okay. Actually, you guys heard my voice for quite some time. I'm going to let JP read this whole story, and... the reason we're reading this whole story, which is five pages, is because, and he probably wants to read it because he's sick and tired of me screwing up on the sentences, but the reason we want to read the whole story is that you get the whole gist of Bill on the open source community and what's going on in the world of Linux and Windows.
All right, this is apparently basically about Bill taking credit for open source software, which I'm not sure what he did, but here's what he says. Thanksgiving week is always difficult for me. PBS wants my column early, of course, but the real problem is that much of what I write is often lost to readers, obscured by the effects of whatever that chemical is in turkey meant that makes us fall asleep. Oh, that is harder than that. People simply don't remember what I write that week, which is, of course, this week. I have to work all the harder to shock them out of their holiday stupor. So the shocking questions for this week are, 1. Is Bill Gates really the father of the open source software movement? And 2. If he isn't the father, did he violate a crucial IBM non-disclosure agreement and ought to pay billions in damages to Big Blue as a result? It's hard to imagine Bill Gates claiming to have started or even helped to start the open source movement, especially since he's been widely quoted as once describing it as communism. But claiming paternity, he kind of sort of did at Microsoft's recent annual meeting while answering questions from shareholders. Here's the fateful question. It appears to me that the open source movement is gaining momentum. And as I understand it, the key to success of a software protocol involves efficiently building an ecosystem of developers and users, resellers, and so forth. Isn't the open source model a more efficient paradigm for building such a community around your products? And isn't perhaps Microsoft maybe on the wrong side of that trend in the long term? Here's Bill Gates' answer, or at least the first part. The complete answer is quite long and circuitous, and it can be found under one of the links on the next page, which is irrelevant to you. So here's Bill's answer. Let me start out. Really, the reason that you see open source there at all is because we came in and said that there should be a platform that's identical with millions and millions of machines, and the BIOS of that should be open to everybody to use, and all the extensibility should be there.
No.
Okay. And so it is this very predictability that once we had gotten the PC going and gotten going and with hundreds of millions of machines out there, that it had always been sort of free software and the universities would flourish, and there would be more of that. I guess we can forget, then, about MITS giving to the world the S-100 bus, Gary Kildall inventing the ROM BIOS for his operating system, and Steve Wozniak completing Apple II as an open architecture with millions of users. Microsoft even made CPM cards that could be installed in Apple IIs, and all this was years before the IBM PC and PS-DOS were introduced in 1981. The gist of Bill's argument is that open source requires a large pre-installed base of genetically identical computers, and that base was provided by DOS and Windows. Okay, maybe we can buy that, but then Bill goes on to claim that the BIOS, the basic input-output system that sits between the operating system and the computer hardware, should be open to everybody to use. Tell that one to IBM, which somehow thought that the IBM PC BIOS was their property. They held a copyright on it, after all. Compaq Computer spent over $1 million reverse engineering the IBM PC BIOS to create the first IBM PC clone. If Microsoft had been working so hard to open up that BIOS, Compaq could have saved their money.
Just to interject, the reason that they open up the BIOS is that they can get a larger market of people participating in supporting their operating system, which means more hardware, which will allow them to advance past any of the other vendors like Apple, or anybody else who would have come up, which basically means a more selected platform, hence making their Windows operating system sell more.
So what was Microsoft's role in operating in opening up the PC BIOS? If they were indeed pioneers in this effort, then they were, as one of my Canny readers suggested, violating an IBM non-disclosure agreement and would have been subject to billions in penalties. That was long ago, and the statute of limitations has expired, so Bill might be telling the truth, admitting that he deliberately undermined his old partner, the company that made Microsoft what it is today. Or Bill could be bending the truth a bit, though I can't imagine why. Frankly, neither answer makes Microsoft look very good. I needed another source to help me converge on the truth, so I emailed Jack Sams in Florida. Jack was a guy from IBM who was sent to Seattle to meet with Microsoft back in 1980 and tell them about the still-secret IBM PC. He was also the guy who mistook Gates for an office boy at the start of that meeting, and Jack had a lot to say on this subject. Bill responded like a true politician by switching the question from open source to freeware, then to open architecture, which he claims to have prompted IBM to adopt for the PC, said Sams. Bill did, in fact, influence the IBM PC interface architecture, but our open architecture decision was ab initio. Ooh, getting fancy with the Latin. Your reader challenged Gates' claim by noting that the IBM BIOS chip is highly proprietary. He didn't distinguish the copyrighted chip from the interface architecture it implements. The chip is indeed copyrighted and could be infringed. The open architecture it supports was extended by Paul Allen's DOS 2.1 to actually support dynamic addition of features and capabilities at runtime. This DOS and BIOS open architecture has been public domain since it first shipped. So everyone is more or less right. Bill remains an artful dodger and a selective rememberer, but aren't we all? Here's the open architecture BIOS history as I saw it during 1980. IBM's product development plan for the PC assumed almost from day one that we would have to rely on a number of independent third-party hardware and software developers to respond to the demands of a mass market. Think programming languages, word processors, games, spreadsheets, joysticks, a million machines in a three-year program. We consciously intended to host other vendors independently develop software, and we were almost completely dependent on third-party peripheral devices, like color video, disc, tape, printer, communications, because our own available input-output was hardwired for data encoding. The product strategy demanded a reliably defined interface that allowed other vendors' hardware to physically and logically attach to the PC bus and for other vendors' software to access all system services. The assembler source code that implemented this BIOS was written by David Bradley of IBM in Seattle in consultation with Microsoft. Its design was limited by three givens. 1. Microsoft's 8086 version of ROM BASIC. 2. The 8-bit input-output bus and device control architecture inherited from the IBM Data Master. And 3. The existing 8088 motherboard design that was planned as an upgrade for the Data Master. These hardware bootstraps were never acknowledged in the official histories by IBM, and may well have been concealed from Bill Gates until early 1981, hence his claim to have persuaded us to use a 16-bit chip. Somebody nodded wisely and said, good idea, but the 8088 prototypes were already running in August with IBM 8-bit input-output. The BIOS code was written very early, around September to October 1980, during the first agreement we negotiated with Microsoft in 1980. It established the infamous 640K memory boundary and other simplifying conventions to allow the system to run entirely from ROM. IBM copyrighted the chip and published the interfaces at first customer shipment. I'm sure there were arguments against publishing until the last minute, and Bill would certainly have had an input, but that's just my opinion. I was out of the loop after 1980. At this level, Bill Gates could certainly claim to have influenced the open architecture strategy. He was our consultant. He had practical experience interfacing BASIC to a succession of systems with a variety of ASCII input-output devices and device controllers. He was the first, we expected, of many vendors whose products would become replaceable parts in PC systems. However, the open architecture strategy was entirely deliberate on IBM's part. We expected to defend our own hardware market by, 1, being the lowest cost producer of the core system, asserting copyright protection for the BIOS chips, quickly offering a series of cheaper, faster, better upward-compatible systems and upgrades, and staying out of the PC software development business. All were relatively successful strategies through the PC and PCAT. Although our reliance on overseas suppliers set the stage for the PCAT clone takeover as soon as there was a reliable source of reverse-engineered BIOS chips. When the PC division began to plan an 8386 AT in 1983, the IBM Corporate Management Committee took the business back from Don Estridge and directed its new management to redevelop the PC as a proprietary IBM product with normal profit margins and a full range of proprietary software and input-output. So sad. Bill dodges another one. Those interested in slightly more recent computer history might want to know about next week's celebration of the first 10 years of QuipTime. Apple's extensible multimedia technology. The amazing thing about QuickTime is that there was nothing like it before, and everything has been like it since. Look at the guts of RealPlayer or Windows Media Player, and you'll see structural copies of QuickTime. It's very hard to be an original, to be the first, and still survive a decade later, but QuickTime does all that, and it might even get the last laugh. Apple is rumored to be preparing an MPEG-4 player for QuickTime. The QuickTime file format is already used by MPEG-4, which ought to give the system perpetual legs and a real advantage against more proprietary solutions from Real and Microsoft. Back in 1990, when Apple first conceived of QuickTime, the world of multimedia was one of Laserdiscs. A multimedia application was a HyperCard stack connected by a serial cable to a Macintosh. The stack let you navigate to a particular clip. The video was then played on a TV screen. In 1991, the big step forward was to display that video on the computer screen, but you still needed the Laserdisc. And when Apple management announced QuickTime in 1990, the idea was very much about perpetuating and supporting that model. The QuickTime team subverted that whole system by saying that every PC should be able to play video on its own, no special hardware. So they developed software, only video and audio, that scaled itself to match the user's machine. Contrast this to the PC industry, which in 1992 was obsessed with multimedia PC, which was basically just a sound card plugged into a stock PC, miles apart. The QuickTime work put on the foundation for great groundbreaking titles like Myst and Explorer 1, and set the model that was later followed for MPEG 4 and DVD. Work on QuickTime 1.0 was completed in 1991, with a product launch at the San Francisco Macworld Show in January 1992. There will be a party, of course, held on December 1st in San Francisco to celebrate the anniversary. Proceeds are earmarked to raise funds for a permanent QuickTime Museum exhibit. Now, if only there was a similar group called Friends of Bob.
Okay. What that means, what that whole article means, is that Bill is basically saying that I was a revolutionary myself, and I had started up the whole open structure to get everybody involved on the PC. Okay, the reason that that happened was that he knew that he was going to make money. He knew other people were going to make money. Everyone was happy. Meanwhile, everyone was accepting Windows. Fine, it's his right. He's a businessman, and it was a great move. So he's trying to compare that to the open source community. And then by saying that, as far as in the article when they moved over to QuickTime, they're actually kind of adding that, hey, he wasn't the only one to do such amazing feats back then. So they're kind of downplaying what his total recognition is trying to be, is that, you know, there are other people out there who are being influenced, revolutionary as far as doing their formats. The reason I wanted the whole article read is that this has nothing to do with the open source community. And this is what he tries to compare to the open source community. Okay, great. He opened up the machine for hardware vendors alike everywhere. I love it. I think it's great. I think it's the way it should be. If I had an Intel machine or whatever it is, and I could only put in certain proprietary things, it'd be terrible. It'd be crappy. It'd be just like the monopoly that's happening nowadays with Microsoft, and I don't like it. So I congratulate Bill on that. But it has nothing to do with the software. The software went away, but it's not as impactful as the software. Great. Let's just say we had a proprietary type system, and that kind of person allowed only certain people to write for it and certain people to not write for it. Well, for a while, Macintosh was like that. Back in the Apple days and stuff, and a couple other things are quite proprietary. Now it's not like that once they moved over to the PowerPC type system. But they essentially lost to Microsoft because they didn't have that type of open market. So I believe eventually that would have been developed. Now we're seeing the closed market of software as being the popular dominant thing, which is the Microsoft software and the Microsoft operating system. Well, as we're seeing, as revolution, as things tend to go again over and over and over in history, now we're seeing that people are getting upset and seeing since Microsoft, because Microsoft had Windows 98 and played video games and stuff like that, fine, you know, no big thing. You're not thinking that they're eventually going to try to come in and dictate how you use your computer. Well, now they're starting to see those Microsoft showing themselves as trying to be dominant, monopolizing, and sort of a dictatorship of technology. And that's why we have Linux. And, you know, if it wasn't Linux, it could have been something else. But right now it's Linux. And what Linux is it's an open source software, which affects you way more largely than the hardware does. The hardware really affects maybe you on a small level if you had a proprietary hardware system. in dealing with it because you probably want a better piece of hardware and somebody else couldn't offer it because it's proprietary. With software, it's quite different because software has so much power over you than the hardware. The hardware works and it functions accordingly, but the software is very controlling over what you can do and allows you to open new opportunities or hence close opportunities to you, and some people hold the key, which would be Microsoft in a way. How you doing, BR?
I'm doing quite well, thank you. Because I'm just envisioning that this all comes down to the whole thing, is like Microsoft is trying to keep everything structured, even though they came up, you know, saying that they wanted everything to be open source so everybody could have control, you know, be able to influence the system. But now they're closing it all, that all off. But well, yet, you know, like...
It was closed, but now they're more in power.
Well, it was like the IBM original architecture was open source, am I right? That's kind of what I got from that article. The original software development was open source.
Most of it, yeah. So except for the BIOS.
Yeah, so they could actually have other people, you know, create software for that operating system, right?
And hardware for that PC.
And hardware. So, because you can't have an open source that just was with hardware if it doesn't work with the software. So they both got to be open source and both be able to communicate with each other. So now you have, it went from an open source, so it was able to everybody be have access to be able to create new things on it, to manipulate it, to conform it to their own will.
So let me interject real quick, is that it did allow people if they want to develop something a lot better than Windows, but hence, you know, it was all free at that time and it was great, but then of course now we have a winner, which was Windows out of that system, or Microsoft.
Right, and so now that they're trying to close everything off and keep everything to themselves, so that is the way that they are structurally taking control of the whole system and keeping control. So it's perpetuating it because they're getting into more and more different, essentially, genres of software development, of new processes, and they're keeping those closed. They're keeping control over it. And now with Linux, it is actually open. It's open back up, so everybody has control. Everybody can manipulate it with a little bit of knowledge.
Which you really see that pattern anywhere Microsoft sticks its fingers in. According to everybody who knows Bill Gates, he's a really competitive individual. Like, he has to win, and you can see it in everything he does. For example, Microsoft just came out with their home video game console, the Xbox, and what they're doing, whereas companies like Sega, Nintendo, even Sony, as a hardware manufacturer, go out and they make their own great games. Sony has a lot of good games, obviously, and they try to attract exclusive content to their consoles and everything. But Microsoft, really, instead of trying to make any good games, I mean, they have a couple of games out there and everything. What they're trying to do now is just buy. They bought the company that makes Oddworld, and now they're making that exclusive. They're going to try and buy Take-Two, which makes Grand Theft Auto, and bring that into their company. So instead of offering more to the consumer, they're buying things up so that now they can say, oh, you can only get that on Microsoft Xbox. And because they have so much money already, they can take $1 billion hit and still keep going. And that's what they're doing with Xbox. They're going to lose a lot of money.
They're going to fight their
way into your living room. And then they're going to make it so your only option is buy an Xbox. And eventually Nintendo, if that model works for them, is going to have to fold. Instead of giving the consumer more options, they basically brute force the industry and beat everybody else out, and then the consumer loses.
Right, and that's pure capitalism at its finest. That's what the free market system is all about. But what we're talking about here, this whole, you know, this show, whole
show
is
about
based
monopolizing.
On, yes, well, that's where pure capitalism, you know, falls apart, is when it all becomes one world system. You know, it becomes a complete monopoly everywhere. And what Linux is doing is actually like this little proletariat uprising of, we're taking back control. And all of our complaints about Microsoft is a complaint against capitalism and the ideological of it, and essence of it, that it's faulty in a pure form.
Now you get to clearly at what the main reason I do the show is, that options aren't really told to everybody as what their options are. I mean, people don't know what their options are. And basically what In the Now's format is we like to present the options, we like to inform you of the options. And the whole point of that article was to show you the way that it's going. And depending on your value system, you're going to take your own side. And most of our value systems here, basically we want something that's, as far as anything is, can be integrated into our lives. Let's just say if computers were nothing, we just played video games on them, I don't think I'd have so much emphasis on this kind of discussions. But since they're becoming more involved in my life, your life, my children's life someday, you know, I want to have some say-so before it gets to a point where it's out of control. And that's why I think, you know, and everybody's done that. In every generation, everyone's spoken about what their beliefs are and spotted something before it came. And that's pretty much my piece, is that I want to spot that out and let people know what is going on. You should be educated about it. And then ultimately, they're gonna computers are going to be everywhere, and they're going to be integrated in your life. So it's a thing about, you know, like, how do you raise your kids? How do you let things into your environment? Like, what do you accept? Well, now things are pushed in your environment. Like the article about, you know, children have to buy, you know, buy your children laptops for $2,000 laptops for seventh grade. You know what I mean? You're going to have to now think about that in the future. Oh, do I have to get my kids $2,000 laptops? You know, if that becomes a standard, like, do I have to conform to this, you know, what Microsoft gives me as a standard? And the thing is you know, like Linux and a lot of that, anything else out there that could be a derivative of Linux kind of style of thinking in other products as well, as far as, like, you know, maybe a DirecTV versus Cox Cable or something like that, is great for the free market, and that's what we like to support here. There's some things I like about Microsoft, and, you know, since they're the bad guys, in my opinion, right now, I'm going to choose the good guys, in my opinion, which is Linux and other people, even like Mac OS 10 or Macintosh, period. So that's...
But see, that's what's strange about Mac, is their architecture is relatively closed, except for some of their...
except for OS 10.
Yeah, because it's opening back up. But now, what's absolutely beautiful about the pure capitalist system is that once the whole world becomes a monopoly, that everything is controlled by one company, one way of doing things, that is the time where actually the people can rise up, take over that company, and distribute all the power to the people. And that is one thing that we should actually, one mode of operation that we could take, is let Microsoft take over. Is let it infiltrate every part of our life. Make it one pretty much system. You know, everything can talk to everything else, even though it does crash every once in a while. Then once it gets so large that it stops communicating, we take it over, and actually then we have complete and absolute control over our lives.
That's if we take it over.
Oh, well, once they start limiting our freedom, like how they're restricting, you know, the license agreement for their operating system, it will happen eventually.
See, that actually ties in with something me and Dimitri were talking about. It's sort of a cycle, like a whole anarchy thing. I mean, people can, like, you can have one dictator. Basically, we started out, everybody was kind of doing their own thing, and then people said, hey, this is inefficient, let's all get together, and then the three of us can go beat up people, and we can take their stuff. And then that grew to the point where people were like, hey, let's just have a whole country. Then instead of fighting each other, we can put all our resources into building and collecting food. Then we won't, you know, we can build houses and stuff. And then that's how some of the Western world got ahead of, like, say, some of the African countries, is they spent less time fighting and more time building. And then eventually it's going to get to the point, which it kind of is starting to now, where the different countries look at each other and they say, hey, why are we fighting each other? We can spend all our time building more resources, increase our standard of living even further. And eventually the whole world probably is going to reach a point where it's basically all in harmony. But then some of the smaller people are going to look around and say, hey, this is stupid, we disagree with that system, and the whole thing starts all over. Because once the whole world is one system, it's essentially the same as no system, in a way that's kind of difficult to explain.
Right, because that is the ideal point of revolution or change, is that's when it becomes much easier to change. Like right now, with all the different countries, and even to the local level, there's a lot of variation between them, between group to group to group. But once there becomes essentially standards, there's always going to be exceptions to those standards, that something will work better doing it differently. And that's why this chaos for local levels, you know, very small, you know, very different groups that variate, is the best way to do things. And that's what's really scary. We talked about that with viruses, and actually the best way to fight viruses is to have an incredible amount of computer variation or platform variation.
Well, the war is on, and the revolution is now, and it's...
And it's starting on In the Now.
Yeah. I actually started a long time ago, but we're here. We're in the middle of it, and it's... Well, Linux is doing their best, and it's changing some heads, and we'll see what happens. I'm just glad it's there. I'm glad something like that's there, and that's why I enjoy using it. So.
And I just want to let everybody know that when I use the term revolution, I don't mean violent revolution.
Oh, yeah.
Just as a circle that constantly continues.
Because in the now, we're not violent. I hate you.
Well, thank you, my friend.
Just kidding. Here's a rose. All right. To go into our last story, which is two stories. This is pretty no good, but I guess it's good for national security. FBI cracks encryption firewall, or encryption wall. The FBI is developing software capable of inserting a computer virus into a suspect's machine and obtaining encryption keys. A source familiar with the project told MSNBC.com. The software known as Magic Lantern enables agents to read data that had been scrambled, a tactic often employed by criminals to hide information and evade law enforcement. The best-moving technology that the FBI currently uses, the controversial software called Carnivore, has been useless against suspects clever enough to encrypt their files. Because Carnivore reads basically the data that comes across. If it's encrypted, it has no idea how to unencrypt it. So basically this new machine... this new virus, in a way, actually gets into your machine, key logs, steals your keys, your encryption keys, which can be basically brought into another machine and broken down, and most likely eventually cracked. So that's what that is. And then also more on that is that Norton Antivirus and McAfee will not be detecting that virus. So they have agreed with the FBI to not detect that virus and not protect you from that virus. And I think anybody that develops some sort of patch, you know, will be shunned and maybe brought to court.
Scary.
That is incredibly frightening.
Yeah. So, I mean...
Now the government itself is usually in terrorist tactics.
Not terrorist tactics.
No, they are terrorist tactics. Viruses are terrorist tactics.
They're not terrorist tactics. They're viruses. I don't want terrorism in viruses.
Norton itself is a virus.
Yes, it is. It crashed your computer sometimes. From my standpoint, I don't want to confuse terrorism and viruses in the same sentence.
Well, I did.
Okay.
Well, it sort of, infringes on your rights. Because why would we want their virus in our system, but not someone else?
It doesn't terrorize me. It annoys me.
Well, same thing. Terror, annoy, a fly, a mosquito can use terrorists.
You're not worried about a virus killing you. I'd be pretty terrified.
Yeah, but you have to be concerned that a virus is going to, destroy your information, give it to people that you don't want it to. Those are all terrorist tactics.
Let's clarify it like this. There's a little bit of terrorism, but there's also a lot of other stuff that are not terrorism-type activities with these viruses.
All right. What is not terrorist activity with a virus?
Is it not terrorist activity?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to say that everyone's afraid of everything that's going to happen to your machine. Let's just say it's just I know you're going to say everyone's going to be afraid after that. I'm not afraid if somebody gets into my computer. I'm not afraid for anything. If any data is lost, I back it up. If any data gets out, I don't put any private data that I can hack. Every one of my usernames doesn't have a name that resembles anybody on that machine that they could call up and try to, social engineer. And I'm not worried about it. It doesn't scare me at all. It's frankly just annoying. And sometimes I think they're kind of cool.
In the course of my life, I found that pretty pointless to argue about the definition of a word. Like, you say it's terrorism, you say it's not. I think you'll never resolve your argument because it just depends upon your brain what you think of as that word. So there's no possible way to settle the argument.
Well, it is a type of guerrilla warfare.
And it's also a type of liberation of proving that something sucks.
Well, actually, the American Revolution was a terrorist and guerrilla action against the British. But we think it's
a
good thing.
It was the war against the Nazis.
Right. So the whole word is just a little different.
Well, I'm saying it's not all terrorism. You may sound like all terrorism.
It's actually kind of, I can understand it as, you know, a computer really is all theory and all thought. So basically you could do, you could say to a person, you have to think this way. And you've created some sort of a thought or a virus that's in a person's mind, and it spreads. So
yeah, we talked about memes like that. And also how the very structure of the operating system does that very same thing. Mm-hmm. It tells you how to organize your information in that system. So it's necessarily like conforming how you're thinking to remember where you stored your information.
To better put this, is that the objectives of a virus writer are very largely different than the objectives of a terrorist.
How so?
They're incredibly different. I mean,
it depends on the virus and the terrorist.
Right. Well,
in general, they are, though, yeah.
About that code red worm? What was that?
Well, nobody found out who did it, so they don't know why it was done.
But I'm pretty sure it didn't blow up two large buildings full of innocent people. Okay, innocent, quote-unquote, innocent as the usual person
that's
going to work.
Violent terrorism? That's destructive? Yeah, that's...
But that's usually what terrorism is violence.
But there there can be social terrorism where there's really no action taken. It's just
like what you're doing right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're terrorizing me, the fact that you're trying to make this a terrorist issue.
There you go. Now you're actually seeing I'm terrorizing you with this issue.
But viruses don't do that to
me. I'm completely beating you upside the head with this thought.
Well, I don't think virus writers should be called terrorists.
Yeah, but if you were someone who killed people and you knew that this virus might get on your machine and you'd have to spend the rest of your life in jail, that might terrify you.
Well, yeah, but it's not to that point. I don't see how it could
be. I don't think they should be legally classified as terrorists, but they're using the same tactics.
Well, like I said, I've leaned a little bit in your direction saying that there is some terror involved, but you have not leaned in my direction, which I have very good points, that it's not a complete terrorist issue. And you sound like it's a complete terrorist issue.
No, it's not a complete terrorist issue because I'm going to back that up because it helps diversify and create innovation, which is just a mutation, which is no different than cancer as well.
Now they're cancer terrorists.
I just kind of find it sad that people would accept this. Like, you want certain things personal for yourself. You want other people to know about it. This virus is going to go through and make everything known if it needs to. So you're sort of accepting, like, just opening yourself up to, you know, giving your information about you to anybody, to the public, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't accept it. I try to my best to protect these.
Well, that's what that virus is. You'll be accepting it. And, like, Norton antivirus.
Not knowingly.
Norton antivirus is allowing this. And you pay to get rid of the viruses, so why should you even pay for Norton?
Oh, this virus. Okay, the FBI virus. Okay.
Yeah.
They're talking about all viruses.
No, not all viruses.
Yeah, that's pretty crappy. But, you know, it's just one of those things. That is it good to have that kind of security? Is it not? Frankly, you know, if they have it, I don't know if we can change it. But if not, I'm going to try my best to make sure it doesn't happen to me.
Well, it's collusion between the government and a couple of private companies. We're center limiting services provided to the people.
Which goes back to, if you have anything precious and secretive, keep it off the network.
Use paper, people.
Yeah. Keep it off the net. Keep it encrypted, and hide it in your closet. Okay. Except those removable hard drives.
And now, what do you want to do? What do you do when they want to invade your mind and read what your mind is thinking so that they can find out whether or not you're a terrorist?
Did
good
you go
luck.
And you live in a cave.
Bring it on. Try to get my mind and understand it.
I don't think there's an interface that can interface with VR's mind. I think it's called torture.
Like, hey, I'm going to put this bamboo shoot in your eye unless you tell me
what
you're thinking.
I think it looks like that Linux screensaver, Acid Warp, and it's this crazy colors fluctuating on the screen. That'd probably be VR's head.
Yeah, I would actually conform to it. I'd be like, all right, plug it in. Tell me what I'm actually thinking. Come on.
They're like, we don't know, but this makes a great screensaver.
It makes a Scooby-Doo reruns and Richard Simmons in hell.
But our last story is kind of another security story. ICANN eyes DNS security solutions. Basically, ICANN is the supplier of a lot of the domain names. And runs the root servers and a lot of the other name servers that we grab our network names from. And they're talking about that some of their DNS servers, or if not the whole DNS structure itself, has some vulnerabilities and could be used in a could be designed in a better way. So they're looking forward to designing their system in a much more secure environment, and hopefully they will make domain registration cheap, like $5.
Ooh, wouldn't that be nice?
I think we should pay a little bit for domain registration because we are paying for a service that they are running and holding our name in a database and supplying it. But since the market, since they have so many names.
Yeah, that they're almost limitless in the first place, that the supply is unlimited, so of course the...
But they're probably saying, why should we do you any favors, buddy? So I guess that's how it works.
Pure supply and demand.
Yeah. I'm going to leave on that note, unless you guys have anything else to talk about.
Nope.
Sandwiches are overrated.
I like sandwiches.
I like sandwiches.
I survive on sandwiches.
Overrated.
And you know how many actors actually survive on like ketchup sandwiches?
Yeah.
They're actually tasty and somewhat nutritious and incredibly cheap because you can always get free ketchup packages from different restaurants. And then bread houses, well, you can always find those.
This actually
it looks like I'm being tuned out.
It's actually a song about technology. So thank you, Dad.
Because only in a mediated society could he use that statement to the people.
This is Slipboat signing out.
JP telling you, don't be like Mr. McGill.
This is BR saying, tune out.
I'm just Dimitri. See ya.
And he is definitely gay. See you next show.
Hey, we weren't supposed to say that. You're gay. No, seriously.